That was good. I feel like going to bed now. 30 minutes gone, just like that. There's a Hollywood film gone in 60 seconds. If there was ever a meditation film, it'd be gone in 30 minutes. How's the AV? Are we online? All good. Welcome everyone from overseas or locally who may have missed the first part of the meditation, but now we get to do the talk. Actually, I'll do the intro again. So my name's Drew Bellamy, and I'm a former president of the Buddhist Society, and I've been invited to give some talks for this layperson's series. And my talks are the subjects of the Eightfold Path, and tonight we'll be doing right speech. The care line is open tonight. There's a listener on the number, which I believe is displayed on the bottom of the screen. So if you're having any problems, which is usually everyone, including me, don't hesitate to give them a call. They're waiting now. First of all, I'm going to dedicate this speech to my wife, because I've come to realize that right speech is a very important part of harmonious domestic relationships. So if she's watching, which she's probably not, this is for you, Shelley. So I've collated some of the right speech mentionings in the suttas and had a little look online. Again, I didn't have much time to prepare for this talk. Right speech is treated fairly comprehensively in the suttas, but there's not too much of it online on some of the talks. It doesn't get covered a whole lot. A lot of the talks in Buddhism seem to go straight to the high level stuff and karma and devas and infinity and jhanas and flying with angels and all this sort of stuff. But I think right speech is very important, and it features in the Noble Eightfold Path, and I hope I get this right. Right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, which I've covered, and right view I've covered, right effort, right mindfulness, and right samadhi. And I guess the Noble Eightfold Path, I tend to put it into two groupings. There's the first four, such as right speech, view, thought, livelihood, which really set people up for the second part of the path, the more what they call supra-mundane part of the path, which is the right mindfulness and meditation. I understand that when the Buddha was talking about the Noble Eightfold Path, he expected practitioners to sort of have a go at everything as best they could, on the understanding that if you got your act together with the first four, that would definitely make the second four much, much easier. An example would be if you were involved in wrong actions, say you've been in conflict and violence and murder and mayhem, that is going to make it very difficult to sit down consistently on the meditation cushion and get right samadhi. So the Buddha's saying, get the first four right, attempt the other four, and it'll come together much easier. So right speech is at the start, and I guess it's pretty obvious how right speech can help on your spiritual journey. It's after right thought and before right action, and if you're involved in wrong speech, which is going to lead to conflict, then you know you're going to be expending energy on managing these conflicts, and it's going to be more difficult to be mindful and getting the correct meditations. So I think that right speech, if you sort of follow the rules, I guess, that the Buddha laid out in conducting yourself in right speech, it's going to help you in the lay life for sure, and then it's going to help you in spiritual development on the supra mundane path. So I decided to go through three suttas tonight. I looked at a few and I picked out three from the Mahajjima Nikaya, which is the numerical discourses of the Buddha. And this is the book of ones to tens. And it's about 2,000 pages and it's quite hefty. And in particular, I find that in the Mahajjima Nikaya, the books of fours and fives have a lot of very practical advice for lay people who are interested in Buddhism and trying their best to spiritually advance, but maybe sort of can only go so far because of family life. And I've talked about this in my other talks, but I'm getting a first-hand taste now of how far you can and can't go when you're just sort of in the lay world doing the family thing and the work thing. So previous to having my family, I was heavily involved in the Buddhist Society, and I became the president, and all sorts of stuff was going on. I was teaching in prisons, visiting prisons. I don't really consider myself a teacher. And I thought making great progress and having plenty of time for meditation and study, and it was really going well. And I thought I had it together spiritually or was heading in the right direction. And then I had a family, and a lot of that time went out the window. You just don't have the time to do all the stuff that you were doing before, and you get brought back to a grounding of, okay, so what can I do? Well, I can do right speech, right thought, right view. I can work on that stuff, and then when my situation changes again with that good grounding, then move maybe to the lofty attempts at super mundane spiritual development. And in the suttas where the Buddha talks about right speech, of course, in right speech, what applies for the monks applies for the lay people. The monks have a much more strict formula, I suppose. But the suttas that I came across, he was primarily talking to lay people. So the first of the three, so I'm not going to read out the suttas, I'm just going to go through the four or five main points of each one. The first one was in the Book of Fives, number 198, and this one's called the five Ways of Right Speech, and this is basically the go-to sutta for the rules. And the first thing the Buddha says in the sutta when he's addressing, I can't remember who it was, he said the first thing is that you have to speak at the proper time. So timing is important. And he explains that you may have some facts that you need to tell someone, but if they're upset or it's not the right circumstance, you're just going to cause a lot of harm or unnecessary strife. So choose your time wisely when you're speaking. He also advocates point two is speaking gently. So these suttas are obviously, sorry to the overseas audience if I'm going this way, but we've got, everyone was sitting over here and then we had some other people come in and now they're sitting here, but the bulk of the people are over here, so I'm just trying to be inclusive. So he talks about speaking gently, and this gently word is the English equivalent of something that was transferred from Pali, but I think it could also be described as speaking calmly and rationally. And the circumstance here is, if you've got to break some bad news to someone, that their spouse or family member or something's died, it's not going to do you any good to run up to them in a massive hysterical fit and bawl and cry out that their spouse has died. That's just going to make the whole situation worse. So the Buddha's saying, try and speak gently, and almost that would come back to try and speak mindfully in the moment and appropriately. The third one in this sutta is that he says that you should always speak beneficially. So he's talking about, not pointing out people's faults or being negative. We all We all know what our problems are. We all know what our shortcomings are. And it certainly doesn't win you any friends to be pointing out other people's faults. But I think that it would win you friends if you were being honest about perhaps someone's virtues or good points. The fourth one is that he said that you should always try and speak with a mind of loving kindness, which is a good one, because the opposite of loving kindness is anger. And I know that in Western and Chinese culture, there's many similes about don't speak when you're angry, or don't write a letter when you're angry, or don't write an email when you're angry. And so the Buddha's saying, yeah, don't get into conversations with people when you're angry. I've had advice from people before who've said to me, if you're triggering and you're angering, leave the room, get out of the room, go away, calm down, and then come back. And finally, he talks about the fifth one is in right speech, is to speak the truth. And I found another sutta where he talks about community responsibility, effectively, in right speech. And he talks about how if you're summoned before a court of the land, the craftsman's guild, the king's court, some sort of community thing, or a meeting of the family elders, that if you're asked questions in any of these situations, you must always speak the truth, and also never, he talks about never holding back as well. And today in our legal system, that transfers into basically perjury, where you're forced to, you have to speak the truth. And in this particular sutta, which I haven't got the number and I can't remember much of it tonight, the Buddha talks about how if you don't do that, it's a corrosive effect on society, and it reduces confidence in those institutions and well, guilds and whatever he was talking about. So then in the second sutta, this is in the Book of Fours, number 82, he talks about the four ways of wrong speech. So the Buddha was always pretty good. He'd give you the affirmative and say, this is what you should do. And then just to be thorough, he'd give you the negative and say, and don't do this. So it's crystal clear. So on the four ways of wrong speech, he kicks off with don't lie. And we can obviously see the ramifications of lying. And I've heard the question asked before, actually, to monks like Ajahn Brahm, oh, well, what about white lies? What about if someone says, whatever the situation, has my dad died, and they're in a medical situation, and you know that if you tell them that they have, that may further complicate their situation. And the suttas are quiet on this. They don't talk about white lies. But I think that you could pull that back to the first point of the last sutta, and instead of telling a white lie, you could choose to speak at the proper time, perhaps, or to only speak beneficially. I think white lies and the myriad of circumstances that could arise around that get very complicated very quickly. And the problem is with lying that you tell one and then you've got to tell another to cover up the first one, and on it goes. So, yeah, as best I could, I'm not sure about everyone else, I would try not to lie and then maybe avoid telling the whole story and waiting for a proper time. Maybe we can talk about that after this in the question time. So the second thing is the Buddha says in wrong speech, no divisive speech. So he gives examples of not going to one person and saying, oh, have you heard this second person is planning some bad thing, or have bad things have been said about them and you shouldn't trust them. So the Buddha's saying when you're speaking about other people, to other people, it shouldn't be, your aim should not be to bring about strife and conflict and break up groups. Don't be a Machiavellian, I guess, because it's only going to lead to trouble. The third point is he says no harsh speech, which I guess is the counterpoint to to speaking gently. I'll just say here that I'm not preaching that this is the perfect way to live, and I've never done any of this. You know, in my life, I've definitely broken all these rules at some point, and paid the price. And harsh speech is something that I've, with my personality type, is quite easy for me to get into and hurt other people's feelings. I've been at the receiving end, so I can understand how he's talking about avoiding harsh speech. And then the last one in this sutta, he says that you shouldn't engage in idle chatter, which I also interpret basically as gossip. You could say divisive speech is gossip as well. And as far as idle chatter goes, I'm absolutely certain it's one of the 272 rules the monk's rules, the Patagodia. No, that's a dinosaur land. The Padamokia. Ajahn Brahm. Sorry? Yeah, the Vinaya rules. The monks are completely forbidden against idle chatter, and you can see why. I've read another sutta where the Buddha talks about how idle chatter can lead to divisive speech, but he gives examples of how idle chatter, eventually, when people get together and get involved in idle chatter, it goes downhill into negativity. So it starts out nice. For you can imagine the first 5 minutes, oh, hi Dennis, how are you going, this and that, blah blah blah, how's your wife, yes, nice, how's that rain, how's that football, oh gee, the other day I got a speeding fine, oh, the police, they're just revenue raisers. And you can see how quickly things go downhill. The Buddha said no idle chatter. And I was thinking about this today when I had about 10 minutes spare before I came to the speech, unfortunately. And I thought about the gossip magazines, which is like a print form of idle chatter. At the newsagent, the Woman's Weekly, and I don't know, New Idea, where they constantly have fake pictures of the royals breaking up on the front cover, and all this sort of scandalous stuff going on, which never turns out to be true. And it's all photo-doctored and whatever else. And it leads to trouble because, sure enough, those magazines are always getting sued by people for making up fake stories and carrying on. So there's definitely some wisdom in avoiding idle chatter. And, I mean, I always think I wouldn't want people gossiping and rumouring about me, so absolutely stay away from doing it to others. And finally, in the final sutta that I chose to run through, again, the Book of Fours, number 73, the Buddha talks about the four qualities of a bad person in wrong speech. And I would just say that you know, you run through these things and then you get it into your mind, oh, if you're a Buddhist, then it all has to be flowers and honey when you're talking, and you can never say a bad thing about anyone. But in the suttas, most definitely, the Buddha comes across very stern at some times. So, of course, I don't record any swearing or arguing, but when he's talking or debating, I should say, with the other schools or ascetics, or where he's basically disciplining a monk for breaking the rules and being bad, the Buddha is strict and stern. And that's what it seems like in the writings, and that doesn't convey his delivery, but what's written about what he said, he might be strict and stern, but he comes across factual, cool, and he sort of, after he admonishes someone, gives a little bit of hope for them at the end to sort of go away and try again and then come back. So if you're into Buddhism or consider yourself a Buddhist, which most people in the West don't, because they don't want to be labelled as, I don't know, something, and they prefer to say that they just follow Buddhism or are interested in Buddhism. And even as the president of the Buddhist Society, I found myself on many occasions saying, "Oh no, no, no! I'm not a Buddhist. I'm just following it." And then here I am at the temple and on the committee. And anyway, I guess we don't like labels these days. So, in the book of 473, the four qualities of a bad person, and this is classic Buddha, and he's definitely in a debate in this sutta with some other ascetic. Just from the language that he uses, but he says, if you see any of these actions being conducted by someone, you can bet they're a bad person, and try and not associate with them too much. So the first thing he says is that a bad person in wrong speech will always disclose the faults of others to others, even if they haven't been asked. So this sort of comes back a little bit to idle chatter or divisive speech or gossip. So he's saying, and fair enough, don't go around telling other people that the third party is, I don't know, whatever mischief they've been up to. Just stay out of their business. Another quality of a bad person in wrong speech is that they do not disclose the virtues of others, even when asked. And when pressed, they will leave gaps and omissions in the virtuous person's behavior. Yeah, so I guess this particular bad person will bag someone out and tell everyone in the world about how many faults they have, which may be true, but then they'll never say, "Oh, and you know, James is a good fellow and he, whatever, gave to charity or something or other, built a temple." So I guess he's saying, don't be negative about people, and if there's an opportunity and it's factual, perhaps say something nice about them and be positive, which is fantastic behaviour. Like, I don't want anyone to talk about my faults, but if you see anything good about me, please tell others. And I'll do likewise. Just give me the list. So three out of four, this particular person in bad behaviour within speech does not disclose his own faults even when asked and pressed. I guess, you know, there's two angles to that. The person is covering up, and then actually when they're asked, I guess also then they get into lying by not disclosing anything. And I found in my own experience that as I've gotten a bit older and moved into midlife or the start of midlife, it's actually nice to own your faults, as long as I guess you've acknowledged them and you're working on them. I don't know about the people in the audience, but I just don't care anymore. Like, if someone says, "Whatever. You did harsh speech the other day," I say, "Yeah, I did. I did. And I said sorry, and it's been on my conscience, and I'm working on it." And then there's just this dropping of the baggage, rather than trying to hide things and cover up. There's a lot of energy that goes into that, and you have to ask yourself the question: is the cover up and the hiding worth it? Then the last point in this final sutta is the quality of a bad person in wrong speech, is that this person will, I'll keep using the male, his, whatever, but I'm just taking out the suttas and I'm not being sexist. So he discloses his virtues when not asked and even expands on them. This person sounds like a rascal. That last sutta, all three of them are great guides to right speech. And I guess I just wrap up with three quick summaries of right speech at different levels. So there's right speech in the community, there's right speech at work, and then there's right speech at home. And I of course would advocate for right speech in all of them. And why is that? Because of the negatives. So right speech in the community. What happens when there's not right speech in the community? And the classic example is, let's start at the highest level of politics. When the leaders of the community are engaged in wrong speech, it causes all sorts of strife. And let's talk about January the 6th in America. So there's Donald Trump, and you know he's out there rallying up the right wing and doing all sorts of tweets and causing all sorts of problems and polarizing people. And then on the 6th of January, because of what he's been saying, you know, they've stormed the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. A policeman got shot. People have been injured. That's an example of right speech or wrong speech doing great harm in the community. And, you know, America, during his presidency, and I'm not particularly left or right wing, but that guy was a disaster. He's polarized it, and they haven't recovered. And he set those two camps up, the extreme left and the extreme right, just to be going for each other all the time. And it'll take someone to pull it back together. I don't think it'll be Joe Biden. Maybe the next president. But that's just an example of. You know, Donald Trump would have broken all of these, all 11 points of whatever we've got here that Buddha laid down, for sure Donald Trump broke them all. A lot of politicians do. I'm just singling him out because he's a great case study at the moment, but a lot of them do, and he's an example of the extreme, and in the extreme it's gone wrong much, much more quickly than other politicians who may do it at a slower pace or more sly. So Donald Trump's 6th of January case study is crystal clear as to why we need our leaders in the community to have right speech to avoid that. Right speech in the workplace. In Australia, the workplace is pretty well regulated, and if you're not doing right speech, you're losing your job anyway. So in the workplace, as a matter of survival for your job, you have to be engaged in right speech, and you can't really be too harsh or gossiping or lying or carrying on like that. You'll be in trouble quickly. And there's even laws around it in regards to sexual and racial discrimination, and those extreme types of speeches that can do harm to people is legislated. So of all the places to find right speech, actually the workplace is probably the most common because it is fairly regulated. And then finally, right speech at home. So right speech at home is very, very important to keep a family together in the lay life. We don't want to be involved in broken families, and the right communication between your partner is obviously important. And, you know, in my experience as well, you'd be surprised. You come across a bit harsh or do something wrong with the right speech, and then they fire back, and then you fire back, and before you know it, it's escalated. And then you've got kids watching it, and, oh, okay, that's what mum and dad do. Oh, that must be normal. Then they take it into school or the playground, and then it spreads, and then all of a sudden it's getting into the community. So, right speech at home is a cornerstone for harmonious relationships. And who wants to get right speech correct in the community, and then right speech at work, and you come home, you're tired, and you're not following those rules that you use to survive in the workplace and have a good community. You're not doing it at home. And then you've got strife at home, and then you don't really have any shelter. And if you don't have that, and you from the right speech, then you're not sitting down on the meditation cushion and doing the other stuff that you may strive for in Buddhism, because there's too much strife in your life. And of course, right speech can wrong speech inevitably leads to wrong action, and then the stakes are increased, and the outcomes can be much worse when you put wrong speech into wrong action. So that's 30 minutes, and I'll wrap the speech on right speech up there. I hope that it was informative. My talks have tended to be quite factual and pseudo-based, but that's because I'm just a lay guy that's been invited to speak here, so I've got to ground myself in something. So I might just open the floor now and the online viewers out there for any questions or conversations or comments on or experiences you've had on the right speech tonight. And if there's not much, then I open it open the floor just for any general Buddhist questions. Karma, rebirth, meditation, why do the monks shave their heads, you know, ask anything. Thanks. Okay. Any questions from... Oh, great. We've got a question from the floor. Thank you. Oh, we might just grab the microphone, actually. Is it? Can we get the mic? Just so the people online can hear you. Great, Dennis has got the mic.
So you gave an example of what the Buddha would do when he was disciplining others. It's cool, yep. Factual, and he would give a bit of a...
Oh, can you speak up a bit, sorry?
Basically, you gave some example of when the Buddha would discipline others,
yep.
And yet he still didn't break right speech. He didn't go into wrong speech. He was still cool and factual, and he gave some hope at the end that they could improve for later.
Yeah.
And often the situation that you're in is that you might be around people who are gossiping, and does he give direction?
Mm. Yeah.
Situations.
Yeah, he does. So that's a whole other topic, but basically the Buddha talks about spiritual friendship as far as the Eightfold Path goes, which includes right speech, which includes staying away from gossiping people. In one of the suttas, he talks about how spiritual friendship is basically, it's one of these paradoxes, the whole of the Eightfold Path. And so what he's saying is that you need to be associating as much as possible, it's not practical, but as much as possible with people who are knowledgeable about the Dharma and conducting themselves in a correct manner most of the time. We're not perfect, we all slip. And so by inference, those situations where you might be forced into a group or something where there's gossip going on, the Buddha's effectively saying, get out of the group or don't partake in the gossip. So in my own life, when I was much more junior than when I am now in the workplace, so I mean, full disclosure, I run my own company with employees, and I've also been a officer in the military. But before all that, I was a junior in the military, and I was, you know, sweeping decks and cleaning toilets, and I was a junior in mining companies, and I know what you're talking about. You know, at the sort of operator level rather than the management level, you know, gossip at morning tea or whatever, and oh, so and so is a dirtbag, or it's worse than that, whatever they say. And you just sort of have to sort of grin and bear it and pull back a bit. Because, you know, if you actively push against it, then you're going to be isolated, and that's going to make your life even harder. And in these suttas, the Buddha's not saying, when you see someone doing wrong speech, push back against them and stand up, you know, for the cause. He's just saying, don't do it. Don't do it, right? Let them gossip and bag out and carry on. Obviously, if it got into wrong action and you're in a situation where there's just a group beating a person up, well, that's a totally different story. You know what to do. Just pull back from it. Just pull back from it. And, you know, as you get older and more senior and whatever it is you do, you just because of the positions you have, that doesn't come up as much. Unfortunately, then you've got to manage it. because people come to you with the problems. But don't partake in it, pull out of it, don't get dragged into it, don't make yourself a pariah. That's as good as it gets. It's not a perfect world. That's probably a good survival tactic.
Great, thank you.
Thanks. Oh, we got some internet questions. Any more questions from the floor? I'll tell you what, if there's not, we'll do the internet questions and then people can, if they want, ask me anything. Okay. Amy, go. Is there an introduction Buddhist book for beginners? Yep. Thousands, millions at the airport and places like that. The BSWA has a number of books through the bookshop online, including a few good ones written by Ajahn Brahm. I'd tackle one of those. There's also a few airport popcorn books that I read when I first started out many years ago by a guy called, he's a Perth guy, Harrison. Buddhism for Beginners, I think it's called. I think that's just, Buddhism Makes You Happy. Yeah, they're nice, lightweight, easy introductions into Buddhism, a lot of hope. He doesn't really deal with too much of the heavy stuff, which is good. That's what you want as a beginner. Because if you come straight to Dharmaloka, especially in Theravadan Buddhism, so Buddhism is basically split into three. There's this one, early Buddhism or Theravadan, Mahayana, which is basically North Asian, Japan, Zen, those type of people. And then there's the latecomers, which is the Tibetan type Buddhism. So I just like to set the record straight. Whenever people say, oh, Drew, you're into Buddhism. Oh, do you worship the Dalai Lama? No. The Tibetans came into Buddhism, I think it was around about the 13th century, probably about 1300, 1400 years before the Buddha. So they're latecomers. They have a lot of cultural stuff from Tibet laid on top. And this Buddhism, Amy, that we're teaching here at the BSWA at Dharmaloka, Theravadan Buddhism, is the early Buddhism. It's quite stripped down. It's quite bare. It's not very exciting because there's not much talk about heavens and angels and gods and beating drums and flares and that. So start off with some of those airport Buddhism books, and if you get a taste for it, come down and get into the beginner's meditation. Okay, a message from the Empress of Greenland residing in London. Okay. Hello, Your Majesty. You must be in political asylum in London. Thanks for your talk. Can you perhaps say something on inner right speech? At times, I can get harsh with myself in my mind. Okay, so there's no inner right speech. In fact, that would be right thought, the precursor to right speech on the Noble Eightfold Path. And really to solve or to be better with more right thought, you really have to have right view, the start of the Noble Eightfold Path. And if you're listening to Dharma talks, doing a bit of reading, attempting a bit of meditation, you're already on your way to getting a broader, better view. And then that, especially with a bit of mindfulness practice and early meditation, that's naturally, like tonight when we did the group meditation, it's just going to calm you down a bit. You're saying that you're quite harsh with yourself. That's very, very common, pardon me. Bit of meditation, bit of mindfulness, bit of broadening of your view, you'll find that you'll become over time less harsh with yourself. And another thing that people starting out say is, oh, chatter in my mind all the time. And like the Buddha talked about in that sutta I mentioned, I don't have the number, where if people get together long enough, eventually the thoughts go negative and down the toilet. It's the same with yourself. So if you're always constantly going in your mind, think. Just like when you're talking to someone else, the conversation's going to go, it's going to go downhill into negative scenario creating. So keep watching these talks. When the monks come back, definitely be, they're the experts, be watching their talks. And you'll see when the monks come back and they give their talks, these guys, they spend a lot of time on their own, meditating and not doing a whole lot of other things. And they're quite joyous. They've got all that time on their own and they're not getting negative in their mind. You can see it coming out of them in the way that they do it. Admittedly, they've got a pretty easy life. They're not running families and businesses and paying bills and whatever. They've got their own challenges, but that's the point of going to a monastery, is to simplify your life. And they're quite joyous people. So if you can look at in particular the senior monks and see how sort of radiant and joyful they are, and they're practicing really hard on the path, then if you just practice a little bit, you'll definitely get a little bit of a result. You know, the more you put in, the more you get. So check out my talk on Right View. Do a bit of meditation, think about a bit of mindfulness, maybe read a few books, and just over time, bit by bit, on the gradual path, this is what Buddhism is, it's called a gradual path that goes over lifetimes, you should begin to see good results. And people go, oh, well, that's a bit vague. What do you mean? What's the formula? Okay, so let me just say, if you could get in one Dharma talk a week and three short meditations and just a little bit of personal relaxation time, you'd be seeing results in 3 to 6 months. How's that? Try that and come back to me. It's bound to work, even if it's just a little result. So, thank you, the Empress of Greenland in London. It was a good question. Do we have any more? Come on, big game. No one ever asks any questions when Ajahn Brahm's here or the other monks. So if you're not going to ask it when there's a lowly layman, who's going to ask anything at all? Alrighty.
So, what? Say, for instance, you know, you're hiking, and
you're hiding.
Hiking.
Oh, hiking on the hills. Yeah.
And then, you know, there's ants, obviously, right? When you go hiking.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And then, obviously, one of the precepts is you don't kill, uh-huh. Right? And then you step on it, and you're like, oh no. So, you know, what's your take on that?
It's pretty simple. So all the time I unintentionally kill insects. Just like you're saying, like you're walking down the path or whatever and you step on an ant. And in Buddhism, in the precepts, no killing, there has to be an intention. There has to be an intention to kill. So if you're walking along a path and you know there's ants and you're trying not to step on them, but you do step on one, well, that's not your fault because you were trying to do the right thing, and then just through the physical mechanics of the world, one of the ants died. And then, you know, you could take that to the next level and go, okay, so I was driving down the country road at sunset, and I've done this, and a kangaroo's jumped out, and boom, you smashed it, and the thing's dead. And in fact, when this happened to me, I got out, and it was still alive, and it was writhing around, and I had to get a hammer out and finish it off, because the choice was leave it there in extreme pain on the edge of the road and just drive off and leave it. And so we were thousands of kilometres from Perth, out in the bush on an exploration camp. What do you do? Do you leave the animal in agony with broken bones for hours and hours on the side of the road? We can't drive it to a hospital. We're not vets. We don't have any supplies. What do you do? And these are the questions that will inevitably come up and the situations you'll be in your life. So if you're driving down the road and you hit an animal or you step on an ant and you go, oh my God, I didn't mean to do that, and it's just an accident, You're not in trouble. There's not, as far as I know, and you can go and ask Ajahn Brahm or someone who knows a lot more than me, there's no karmic imprint from it. So if you step on an ant or something happens with a dog on the road or whatever, try your best. I don't know. I've been in situations actually where I've also hit a dog on the road in the car, and the owner's turned up, and we've tried our best to save it. And I've offered to pay for the vet bills to try and resuscitate this dog, and it didn't work out. So as long as you've got the right intent, and you're not out to kill those insects or animals, you'd be all right. You're just an instrument in sort of the karmic wheel that's going around. Yep. Got real heavy real quick, didn't it? Yeah, good question. Yeah, yeah, maybe. Alrighty, so, oh, what's this? Oh, you like the... Oh, is there? Oh, how do I refresh it? Do you know how to refresh it? Oh, I don't know how to use an iPad. I use Android. Anything else from anyone else while we're waiting for the final question of the night? Going, gone. Alrighty. Isabel Kay from the Gold Coast. Right. Where's the line between self-acceptance and self-improvement? That's a nice hard one. Alrighty. I'll make it short. Where's the line? The thing is that there is no line. That's the paradox, because at any one time, you need to be doing both. You need to have self-acceptance of who you are, the way you were born, your strengths and your shortcomings. And the last lady, the Empress of Greenland, she was saying, I can get harsh with myself. Well, you're probably harsh with yourself because you haven't got a lot of self-acceptance going on, because you're expecting this perfect, if not perfect world, then you're the perfect person. And there's no such thing. So unfortunately, you have to accept yourself every day. And accepting yourself is easier if you know that you're trying to do the right thing. So you might be following the five precepts or having a go at the Noble Eightfold Path. If you're doing that, maybe not even to the best of the ability, to what your circumstance can hold you for at the time, I think you can accept yourself. And the classic example in my life anyway is getting older. So every day I get up, and I used to be the most handsome 21-year-old athletic guy ever, dashing military type figure. And now I get up and I look in the mirror and I'm putting on weight and there's grey hair and my vision's not so good. And it's not what it was in my 20s. And you just have to accept it, unfortunately. And when you can do that, then you stop caring. Then you don't have to go out and buy bottles of hair dye and get Botox and do all this sort of stuff. You can just accept who you are and accept that it's not a perfect world. So then self-improvement, you know, what's the line between the two? There is no line. You do both in tandem, because if you have accepted yourself, then you can put that to the side as long as you're behaving. And then you can get on with self-improvement. And what's self-improvement? Well, obviously in the Buddhist hall, it's going to be about the Eightfold Path and things that we've discussed tonight. And there's a lot of resources here that you can tap into. And self-improvement, it doesn't have to be a big makeover job. If you're just doing a little bit, not even every day, you're just doing a little bit every little while and you're seeing something change. And in fact, it can be Buddhism, and then you can add on other things. It can be physical conditioning or, in regards to your career or occupation. If every little while you're doing something to self-improve yourself, then here's the winner. You get a feedback loop to self-acceptance. Oh, look, I finished that course on vocational, whatever it is, hairdressing level 3. I'm going to get a pay rise. I'm more qualified in my trade. Fantastic. All of a sudden, you've got more self-acceptance going on. So I would say there's not a line, and I would say they go in tandem, and you just work on both of them the best you can without beating yourself up too much. Because in Buddhism, it's a long, long path. It's a path of many lifetimes, really. If you're going to get on the Buddhism train, you've got to get with the acceptance of many lifetimes. And as soon as you say, okay, so there's a potential for rebirth, that's how karma works and whatever, and so this is going to go for many lifetimes, you, of course, are not going to come down, and certainly I'm not, get down to the Buddhist hall and go, right, I'm enlightened by 2053. No. Only if you've done a lot of work in the past and have exceptional qualities that are sort of shining through, then maybe you may come here and sort of... You're not going to be on a fast track. You've just done the work a long, long time before. So it's the gradual path in Buddhism. And some people find that frustrating. They go, oh, it's just not quick enough in Theravada and Buddhism, and I just want to be, you know, cured now or whatever else, and it's too frustrating, and I'm going to go somewhere else now. Look at it from the other angle. You've got a long time to get it right. As long as you're behaving right in the present moment, and that doesn't mean being a nun or a monk every single day. It just means being a decent human being, following the basic precepts, following the Eightfold Path, being a decent person. If you just do a bit of that and just live as a lay person, it's okay. It's almost a release. You know, you're not in Christianity or Islam or wherever where you have to strictly follow all these rules or God's going to curse you and put you in a bad place if you don't live up to his or her or whatever it is, expectations at the end of the day. In Buddhism, bit of self-acceptance and a bit of gradual improvement over time, and then just relax into it because it's mainly out of control. Okay, everyone, I think we'll wrap it up there. Thanks for coming, and I'll just do three bows to the Buddha and we'll call it quits. And the helpline's still open. If someone wants to call in from overseas or locally, the helpline is still open. I think the number's probably being displayed on the screen. And some of us may quickly duck across to the tea room for some coffee. And there's one more announcement. Sandra.
Just inviting all my buddies across to the kitchen.
Yep.
For tea and biscuits and good fellowship. And the care line is open until 9 p.m.
The care line's open for another 40 minutes.
Yeah, so please, if you feel you'd like to be listened to in a non-judgmental, friendly way, there's such a beauty in being able to talk to another person.
Yeah.
So don't feel lonely. Pick up the phone.
Pick up the phone. Okay, thank you. All righty.